living some little men and women. They are our past. And maybe, maybe they are our future.
Good afternoon, you're listening to KPFC 88.1, Lakeport, Clear Lake, and all of Lake County. Stay tuned for Inside Out and our guest, Lori Pye. Good morning, this is Tyra St. John on Inside Out. Are you there, Lori?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, so nice to have you here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Tyra. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Lori Pye is the director of the Institute for Cultural Change, a new organization in Southern California, but it goes all over the world. Lori, what is the Institute for Cultural Change?
Well, it's a nonprofit organization based in Santa Barbara, California. And our mission basically is to reach out and engage with people in many different parts of the world who have a desire to promote social, ecological, and cultural change or evolution through the development of communication, education, technology. And we're hoping that this will foster a curiosity, open the imagination, propel people to engage in personal reflection, and start a cross-cultural dialogue. Our aim basically is to create and connect a global community.
I think you were doing that before also to a certain degree in your, what was the name of the organization?
Mythological Studies.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The Mythological Studies program, which I was honored to be a part of last year when it was the subject of violence.
Right, the mythology of violence.
Right, that was a wonderful experience. Just being at Pacifica is a wonderful experience because I think Pacifica is kind of in a cultural change, not just mode, it has been in cultural change kind of since the beginning of its existence, from
right.
my point of view.
Right. Well, we're not formally or officially associated with Pacifica Graduate Institute in any way. However, a lot of us graduated from Pacifica. Many of our board members, our board of directors and our board of advisors have either taught or currently teach at Pacifica, and it's certainly a community that we reach out to as well. The Institute for Cultural Change really has a global community. We have people participate in the website and educational programs from around the world, but certainly the Pacifica community is a huge part of our constituency.
Right. Well, you've had quite a little bit of experience in nonprofit executive management, haven't you?
I have. It's really been what I've done most of my adult career, working with marine conservation nonprofits, from some of those here in Southern California to starting my own marine conservation organization in Latin America several years ago, working with Jean-Michel Cousteau for a couple of years. So, yeah, it's been something that I've enjoyed doing. I particularly like the nonprofit sector.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge part of our culture and has a great deal of influence on, you know, how we're able to effect change in the world.
We have about 350 nonprofits in tiny little Lake County. So I do understand what you mean, and we're all stretched to the hilt, you know,
serve our various
cultural and community needs.
Yeah.
So as an environmentalist, you worked with international NGOs. What are NGOs?
Non-governmental organizations.
Okay.
Basically, the United States calls NGOs nonprofits, and internationally the term is an NGO, a non-governmental organization.
Okay.
Doesn't really work here in the United States because everyone knows that nonprofits here in the United States is very much controlled by the government.
Right. You worked with Cousteau, which is very, very exciting. What did you do when you were there?
There I was in the education department and was director of one of the programs they had, one of the science programs for kids in Santa Barbara.
Uh-huh.
And so we would take kids out into campground or someplace by the ocean where they usually stay for anywhere from 3 days to a week, and basically taught them the ins and outs of the scientific ecosystem along the ocean or the coast.
Wow.
And so that was a lot of fun and very, very gratifying.
You also worked on this Eastern Tropical Pacific East Seascape Corridor.
Yeah, that was in Latin America, South America, and that's the organization I started. It was called Terra Azul, and basically meaning Blue Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked with, mainly we worked with Conservation International, and what we did was forming an alliance with probably over 100 NGOs throughout that eastern corridor from Costa Rica to Panama, mm-hmm. Colombia, Ecuador, to set aside a biological corridor of about 11 million hectares of water to be safeguarded for the marine life there. And that was about a 3 or 4 year project that did come to completion. We were able to set aside a chain of connecting World Heritage sites like Cocos Island off of Costa Rica to Malpelo off of Colombia to Gorgona to the Galapagos all the way down into Ecuador. So it was this sort of chain of protected waters.
So what got you started in that direction?
Well, I actually, before that, worked, I was executive director for Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and we worked a lot in Latin America. But at that time, Sea Shepherd, being a more radical environmental group, wasn't real popular to work with. The governments in Panama, Costa Rica, Colombia, Ecuador really felt like it was too much of a risk. And I had become very passionate about the work down there, so I resigned from Sea Shepherd and went to live in Costa Rica for a while and started the organization there.
Uh-huh.
And so we started working with the ministers of the environment of all four of those countries in order to secure this sort of chain of biological corridor. It was a huge project, and it wasn't just Terra Azul. It was certainly, you know, many, many wonderful nonprofits that worked down there to make this whole thing come about.
Right. I love the name Sea Shepherd.
Yeah.
I just love it, even if it's terribly radical. I don't care.
Well, it's,
I just love
it's
the
a wonderful group. I'm very fond of that organization,
right.
And Paul Watson, and wish them well. They do wonderful work, and you know, there's ways that we have to, find our passion, and that's what Paul does, and
right.
He doesn't change that for anyone. You know, bless his soul.
I think that all of us have had to recognize that although we don't want to be a governmental organization, we do have to work sometimes in concert with some government. For example, our own station, as independent as we are, and we are not governed by the government, although we are FCC licensed.
Right.
We are a nonprofit organization, and we don't let anybody touch our content. Each person who has a show has complete control over their show,
mm-hmm.
You know, unless we're pretty obnoxious and even our audience says, no, no.
Yeah.
No, except, you know, unless we break an FCC law and use some of the wrong words or something
right.
like that. But that's what I really love about our station is we are very independent. However, we did get a $100,000 grant from the U.S. government, which helped us with some of this fabulous digital equipment and put us ahead of most radio stations in the world. We're very proud of what's here. Now you started the Institute for Cultural Change. When did you start that?
I started that last year in May of 2008. Mm-hmm.
And you have a wonderful website, which I want to refer people to.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And is that, do you go to mythology.org or do you go to?
Well, you can get to it through that. We have that link as well, but the best way is to go to instituteforculturalchange.org.
Okay.
It's all one word. It's a little bit of a mouthful.
Yes.
But www.instituteforculturalchange.org.
And I see that you even have a blog as part of the website.
We do. It's a wonderful blog goddess is Dr. Catherine Savela, and she does an incredible job with posting very interesting subject matter and, you know, food for thought. And
what is her name?
Catherine Savela.
Okay.
Dr. Catherine Savela, she manages the blog and heads that up. It's a great place to engage in conversation or network. You know, meet different people and find out who's doing what around the world.
Right.
So, yeah.
Where did you get your southern accent?
Well, I was born in Texas, but I like to say I was born in Texas, but really grew up in California.
I understand what you mean. I was born in Arkansas, but you sound like home. Sound like the same kind of accent.
Yeah.
I can be down there for, you know, one day, and I'm just as southern as all get out.
That's right.
And then I come back and try to regroup with California.
Well, you know, you can take the girl out of the South, but you can never take the South out of the girl.
That's true. So why is the Institute for Cultural Change, why is it important these days? I know, of course, our president, his whole campaign was based on change, but I don't know whether it's the same type of change we're talking about. I mean, we're in massive change in the United States and throughout the world. And so why is this important right now?
Well, it's a really good question, Tyra, because a lot of people are asking me, are you crazy for starting a nonprofit under these economic times? And no, I actually don't think I am. I think it's very important to have an organization like this, you know, precisely because times are so difficult. And there's several reasons for that. I think, one, it provides community. And community is important all the time, but especially when we're facing a global crisis, different magnitudes, not just economics, but there's also a social justice type of crisis that's been going on for a long time as well. And, you know, to have community places where we can either vent or discuss or share ideas, you know, promote curiosity, get our imaginations working together, that's critical. Otherwise, we can tend to sit around and just sort of complain and whine and gripe, and I particularly don't like that kind of, you know, attitude. So the idea behind the Institute was to create a place for community that we could share ideas and maybe come up with solutions. Certainly for the Institute for Cultural Change, our main goal is to provide tools for how to change. Because what we're really trying to do with the community is explore how we might relate to the natural world less destructively, discover ways to interact with one another in less violent, racist, and sexist ways, and to work toward preserving and augmenting diversity.
Right.
And that's really important, not just in United States culture, but that's important for cultures around the world. So my thought, my feelings, or my thinking behind why it was important was, well, we need a place to do that. And, you know, fortunately now we have the technology that gives us sort of a virtual location and tools to reach out to people and provide ways to begin to learn how to change our behaviors and attitudes and belief systems.
Right. What languages do you speak?
Well, I only speak English well, and that's probably negotiable depending on my accent. But I speak a little bit of Spanish, obviously, from working in Latin America for a number of years.
Right.
Un poquito.
Right. That is something that we need to look at, I think. That and getting the technology spread through third world countries so that we can communicate better by, you know, technologically. Do you think so?
I think that's very important, yeah.
Right. How do you see things changing right now? What is your take on, we're right in the middle of it, how do we see it, number one? How do you particularly perceive our cultural change?
Yeah, I'm not sure how we see it because I can't speak for everyone. I can only speak for myself. But, you know, as a mythologist, we can kind of look at a larger picture and break it down and see what's going on archetypally in that picture. And from a mythological perspective right now, we're in between myths. We have left a very old destructive myth, have stepped into trying to move forward into a new myth, and this is the part we would call change. But we also know that being in between myths is a very, very difficult time. There's a lot of tension, there's a lot of stress, there's a lot of anxiety, and all those feelings and emotions are not fun to feel and to engage in. They're necessary for change. I think we have to be able to withstand and suffer through discomfort and fear and anxiety in order to make change happen. It's part of the process. It's not life is a bowl of cherries and, you know, change is going to be very sweet. It may be on the other side, but in the in-between, that in-between liminal space where we're finding ourselves now as a culture is a very difficult, frightening, scary place to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's usually how change works across the board. This has been compounded by economic, you know, crises. And so we find ourselves in a very, very complex place, and I think it's important that we do find community in order to find support through these times. But I also think if we can do the work, and what I mean by that is we can do our own psychological work, do our own part in understanding who we are and how we project our own fears or insecurities onto the culture. If we can draw those back into ourselves and really try to move through some of the muck, we can kind of clear the way. And, you know, that's how change happens. You don't just wake up one morning and, you know, you've changed. You have to work at that. You have to be able to, you know, pull your projections back. You've got to be able to own your own stuff and do the work and not project all this onto the culture or, you know, other people.
So I think
that we are doing that. I think that we are engaging in change. But as we know, and as, you know, I think you and I have talked about ourselves before, Jung said, you know, change is a very slow process.
And we're in it all the time.
It's a constant dialogue. Now, do we engage in that dialogue or not?
So it's not so much change as it is our resistance to change that we have to kind of eliminate. We have to eliminate the old ideas, the old thoughts, the old resistances, the old fears, and dare to trust again, dare to speak out. Is that part of the...
Yeah, I think you know, what you're articulating there is really right on, and certainly from a Jungian or archetypal perspective, that's the work that is being able to, I guess the idea is also very Hillmanian in the sense that James Hillman says, you know, first your psyche and then the world.
Right.
So if we want to produce or create change in the world, that's great. We should want that. But to me, it seems like we need to start with ourselves first, and that's really the premise behind the Institute for Cultural Change as well. I guess I could have said the Institute for Personal Change, but probably no one would have signed up for that.
Right.
That's a little scarier. But,
right.
But the idea behind it is if we're going to create outer change, we have to first create that inner evolution, that inner change.
And you were talking about the financial world and the big problem we have today in our economic stricture, I guess you want to call it, our missing economic resources. I guess one of the things to me is that not only is the financial crisis, but it is based on another crisis, and that is that it has not changed enough, that it still needs just lots and lots of change in terms of our understanding of money and our understanding of material values and our understanding of fair play, our understanding of justice, like you said, social justice.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these people that were kind of, whole industries have been involved in doing what they could for themselves without enough understanding of what it was doing to the other people. So I think this, our new personal change could be something that not only involves ourselves, but could have a strong effect on other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I hope I'm making that clear, but anyway, you said first that Hillman said first your psyche and then the world. It seems that by changing our own patterns, our own, where we've been caught up in that same kind of either arrogance or greed or whatever, you know,
mm-hmm.
of too much self-involvement to something that does involve community.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really proud of Lake County because we are all around a lake. This is eight little towns around the largest lake, I guess, in California.
Mm-hmm.
It's 100 miles around. It's just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had a logistics problem in the past, and especially during the gasoline crisis when it was so high. And now, somehow, all that's happened has kind of brought the community together. It's begun to merge more with the South End and the North End, and some of our towns are 30 miles apart. I'm very proud of Lake County for beginning to consolidate, I guess you'd call it, unify in certain things. So what tools do you think are the most useful that we can bring to ourselves or to the community?
Well, I think probably our most valuable tool is our own imagination, you know, the human psyche and using our imagination for problem solving and just to step back for a moment, listening to you talk about Lake County, you know, the image that came forward was an ecosystem, and it's part of what I teach in the courses on eco-psychology that I teach at UCSB and a couple of other places. But the idea of, you know, the human ecosystem being an ecosystem unto itself, the ecology of the human psyche is very connected, obviously, or interconnected to the ecology of the natural world. And if we think about our ecosystem in relationship to the ecosystem of our culture or the ecosystems of, you know, global cultures, and try to get an image for how that looks and feels, it's interesting because one of the first things students will respond to is they really can get an idea of how disconnected, even though we have the technology and the internet and, you know, this sort of virtual stream of communication, there's still a lot of disconnected and disconnection going on in our world and in our psyches. And part of the problem comes from these places of disconnect. And I think that's what excites me so much about the idea and the feeling of change in the air now, is that we're starting to acknowledge that, okay, there is disconnection here on this planet and among human species, and certainly between humans and the natural world. And we're going back and addressing those places of disconnection in order to establish an interrelationship or, you know, a connection to each other and to the natural world. But we can also take, I think, a step back even further and start that dialogue with ourselves and find out where we are actually disconnected in our own psyches and start to repair those connections. Because, you know, again, what we do inside our own psyches, we're going to put out into the culture. So if we come from a very disconnected, disoriented psyche, that's what we're going to be putting out there. But if we can reconnect our own ecosystem and see how we are, you know, functioning within our own psyche, and then we put that out into the world, then we start to create a healthier ecosystem out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the image that you gave me when you were talking about the counties or the different cities around the lake connecting up, you know, I could just see that happening. That was a very beautiful image that you gave me for that. So I think that is happening in places around the world. So I see this crisis, these multiple crises, is actually an opportunity, because, you know, those of us in psychology, we know that usually we don't start to change unless a crisis has happened.
Right.
And so I
look
at
the federal government passes a budget on December 31st at or January 1 at 3 a.m.
Yeah,
or something
exactly.
Like that, so we don't go broke or whatever.
Yeah, but I actually think it's a good thing that this is all happening and coming out, because we needed to kind of clean up our own ecosystem, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
We needed to clean up the finances and the way things were, you know, happening. The banks and the way we've been doing business economically. What's interesting about this idea of ecology, of personal ecology or cultural ecology, is that it's also very tied into economics. It's not one or the other, or, you know, what's good for the individual or the culture is bad for the economics or the environment. That's always been sort of a polarization, and it shouldn't be. Because both of those are, if we think about the word ecology coming from the Greek word dwelling or household, how we think about our dwelling or how we think about our household, if we can look at ourselves ecologically and think, what is our manner of dwelling in ourselves, and sort of extrapolate from there, then we can ask, well, what is our manner of dwelling, you know, in our culture? And I think we're starting to ask questions like that now and clean up our ecosystem and clean up some of this greed and certainly, you know, egocentrism and arrogance and all the things that have just parlayed into the crisis. It's hard. It's certainly hard on me too, but at the same time, I'm very optimistic about it. I'm grateful that it gives me the opportunity to look at myself and reflect where my ecosystem is. There greed or, you know, mismanagement of resources. I tend to look at things ecologically, obviously, because it's what I teach. So, you know, that's sort of my main metaphor. But it helps. It helps to see what's going on in our personal ecosystem and how we can help the larger ecosystem, you know, evolve.
Would you tell our listeners what you mean when you say psyche?
Well, it's a Greek word. The Greek concept of psyche was soul. And if any of the listeners have read C.G. Jung, they will have come across that word quite a bit. And the idea behind it is that it is the first part of the word psychology, too. So it's the study of, you know, our inner life. It's the study of what some people would call our soul. James Hillman calls it soul work. If we're looking at the psyche, we're looking at the human soul. We're trying to engage with that.
Right.
So psyche and soul are used interchangeably. But the caveat here, Tyron, as you know, is that, of course, we don't ultimately know what psyche or soul is. These are words that we have, you know, formulated and created a psychological definition around in order to give us images to use to do some psychological work with. But, of course, ultimately, it's not we can go out and scan it or measure it or, you know, have something tangible there. So
right. I noticed that you have Thomas More's entire schedule on your site. Or did I flick to it
No.
Unwittingly?
He's on our board of advisors, but...
I thought it had his travel schedule. Maybe unwittingly I went to his site.
Yeah, probably so.
Right.
Probably so.
But anyway, he was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and mm-hmm. I have so much respect for him. What he said about soul or psyche was that part of ourselves that feels at home, or the part of ourselves that feels as though it's connected, I mean, at least soul, not necessarily psyche.
Mm-hmm.
Psyche includes the uncomfortable parts, I guess, as well.
Mm-hmm.
But soul, he was referring to it, he was differentiating between soul and spirit and saying that soul was more the part, you know, where you see a mother wrapping a blanket around a baby and holding it, mm-hmm. and or the part of us that sits and has tea late afternoon and talks with a friend, or, you know, that part of us that begins to feel connected or real or belonging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why the black community has gone through so much pain and so much suffering over the years and so much exclusion, that the community has more soul to it, shall mm-hmm. we say, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
because of having found songs and of course, in the music that they've created and so forth. And that, you know, is what we said was soul music. And then, of course, the white people took that over and everything. And we're all one. But I was just referring to the soulness of people who've gone through pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we strengthen our souls through some of those experiences. And I know Dr. Young said that much of our learning comes through those experiences, that they are instructive to us, that the hard times are just as much instructive as all the good ones that we aspire to. I'm kind of getting off the subject, but
yeah, well, everything's connected, Tyra. Everything's connected. So you're right on the subject, and I think it's well said too. There has been a lot of certainly academic and theological and philosophical discussion on the differences between soul and spirit. That's been a time long conversation, and even some people between psyche and soul. I tend to look at psyche and soul as the same. And certainly there's soulful moments or moments filled with soul, but I tend to kind of look at those the same, and they hold both the conscious and the unconscious elements in them.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the things that I worry about in our culture is waste.
Yeah.
Because we've been such a rich country and a rich culture that I worry about paper.
Yeah.
Paper and waste and cellophane and plastic and all the stuff that has to do with packaging. And I'm one of the big users, because I love to write, and therefore I have a lot of paper, and I print paper of websites that I like and so forth. And yet I worry about it, because mm-hmm. these are trees, and these are part of our natural ecosystem. I don't know what we can do about it, but I used to work with the National Packaging Association, one of my PR jobs, and before I was a therapist. And the National Packaging Association exists because of packagers.
Mm,
and
right.
So many things we start to get into, we can't even get into. They're so well-bound, you know, mm-hmm. with plastic and everything. So I worry about that. I haven't done anything about it except to try to cut back my printing a little bit. And then,
well, you know, trees are a renewable resource. That's one of the things that, you know, people can become sort of ecologically minded more, develop more of an ecological ethos, if we will, on how, again, back to that idea of, you know, what is our manner of dwelling, whether it's in our own home or on the planet, and to understand what resources are renewable and which resources are not is helpful. But certainly paper, because it comes from trees. Trees are renewable resources, so it helps to continue the planting or supporting those organizations that continue the planting of trees. Unfortunately, we're cutting them down quicker than we're, you know, able to grow them, because they take a long time to grow, depending on the tree. But although it's a renewable resource, we can't keep up with the amount of trees being cut down and forests being destroyed. But there is a treeless paper now. You can Google that, and you can find, you know, types of paper now that don't come from trees, and that could be one place, you know, to, if you use a lot of paper, that could be one place to offset that.
Where does it come from?
Some of it comes from rice, and other people are exploring, other companies are exploring other ways to produce a type of paper that we can certainly print and write on and do the same things mm-hmm. that we've always done with paper, but not coming from tree pulp.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, these green businesses are going to start popping up now. Our President Obama has asked for that and is calling for that. Thank the gods, finally. I think there's going to be a whole lot more money put into the kind of research that produces products for us that are more environmentally sensitive and certainly environmentally responsible.
Right. I want to tell our listeners once more that we're listening to Lori Pye, who is the director for the Institute for Cultural Change. And you can go to that website at instituteforculturalchange.org or mythology.org. Institute for Cultural Change is a California nonprofit organization that seeks to reach and engage concerned people in many different parts of the world. So this is not just a U.S. website.
Right.
And it also includes many inputs from different people throughout the world. I liked some of the stories that were on the website.
Oh, cultural myths.
Yes.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite places, too.
And where do you get those? Are they people send those in?
Yeah, they do. You know, people from around the world, the medical doctor he's from India, but he lives in South Africa now, and, you know, just a mother story about her teenagers and artists, and I hope you submit a story, Tyler. You have a very interesting, you know, background and network, so I'd love to see you on there as well. But that is a very wonderful place for people to share their story, or as we would say, share their mythologies, and engage with other people.
Right. They're really interesting, each one. And I wanted to ask you also about a little bit about the I Ching. I'm going to try, I think, to get Dr. Karcher to be on the show.
Oh, he'd love that,
On the Jungian show. Mm-hmm. And maybe within that, I know he has many interests, but one of them is the I Ching.
Mm-hmm.
And what is, I know a lot of people know what the I Ching is and others don't, so why don't you tell us just a little tiny bit about it.
Yeah, that's actually Stephen's specialty. He has written on Kuan Yin as well, but he's probably one of the foremost leaders in the I Ching or Yi Jing. And basically it's the classic of change, which is what that word means in Chinese, the classic of change. And it's a book, it's a technique, and it's a way of practice. It's a very old, probably one of the oldest divinatory systems, and I'm still learning about it myself, so I'm certainly not, you know, any expert on this, and it should probably come directly from Stephen Karcher. He can speak to it better than I can.
I remember I used to try to do it, and I would do it for sometimes hours, and I still didn't understand it. I would try to find one hexagram that I understood
mm-hmm.
because it's very oblique in the way it's written. It's from ancient text.
Yeah, I think that can be very true. I've known about it for a number of years as well, but found it a little intimidating. However, working with Stephen, you know, dissolved that immediately. He makes it much more accessible, and I'm quite mathematically challenged, and so, you know, I thought, wow, I don't know if I want to get into this or not, but I have found that to be, you know, just very, really a false sense of self around that, and engaging in the I Ching and starting to learn it. Basically, what I'm finding with it, Tyra, is very similar to mythology, because it is a mythology. It's an ancient mythology. It's also very interesting to see how it so connects to Jung's work on
mm-hmm.
symbols.
Mm-hmm.
Because what it is a series of symbols that tends to come alive when you work with them. And what I mean by coming alive is that they tend to speak to you. They tend to engage in a dialogue with you. And the opportunity there is for you to dialogue back with them. And in that you know, that cross-dialogue exchange, you gain a lot of insight about yourself through the image and through the understanding of the myth and the reading of the text. I don't know anyone who has translated the I Ching in a more understandable manner than Stephen Karcher, which is probably why he's so popular.
And
why I sort of gravitated to it myself, because if it was going to be, you know, something I'd have to really take a lot of time and work and try to decipher, I knew that I wouldn't be able to do that over a long period of time. I don't have the time to do that. So it's not that I was looking for, you know, a quick divinatory system or how to learn something easy. It wasn't that. But I wanted something that I could find meaning in as I worked with it. Mm-hmm. And as I started to work with the I Ching, symbols came in my dreams. I would dream about the various symbols and sort of downloaded into my system. And so I have found it to be quite phenomenal, quite interesting in the sense of how it has reinforced my Jungian studies, because now I really get what Jung meant about the symbols communicating with you.
Right. Well, I'm very excited about that, and I hope to talk with him soon.
Well, I'll definitely send you the information so you can contact him without trying to...
I really appreciate that. Also, I was reading about Dr. Amitabh, is it Mitra? Mitra, the published poet that's on your Institute for Cultural Change inner...
Oh, he's on the Cultural Myth page? Yes. Dr. Mitra.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was reading his poem. We're a very kind of poetic society up here, getting to be so. We're very active in poetry and writing and so forth. I read his poem on Darfur.
Yeah.
Would you want to read that out loud, or do you have it? You probably don't have it in front of you.
Actually, I do. It's beautiful, and his photography that goes with it, is that not stunning?
Oh, is that his photography?
Yeah, it's
unbelievable. And, you know, we see those images on television, and we don't quite know what to do with them.
Right.
Sometimes.
Right.
And I would very much appreciate your reading that poem.
Well, it's called Darfur, and it goes like this. Darfur. Suddenly a baby cries, malnourished, maltreated, and ravaged. Men, women, and children hang by their skin to mirages. The desert burns the skull of all reasons. Storms that sweep into their eyes locks up within corneas. Daring death to open them. Darfur has no word. Darfur has no meaning. Darfur has death. The baby squeaks because only he has the pride to know when the Janaweed are coming. It is time then. The mirages are slashed open by flashing swords and faceless marauders. Screams will be a welcome whirlwind chasing the sun again. Gives you chills. And that's just one of his poems. He has many, many on his quite beautiful website as well. But
we've read a little bit about that in Darfur and Western Sudan, and it's only through things like this that we understand the depth of the pain and the depth of the suffering that's going on there. Mm-hmm. We read about numbers, but this is about, you know, the individuals and what's happening inside them.
So
300,000 people have already died.
This is part of, you know, this what I was saying earlier, this idea of you know, interconnected ecosystems, and we can't ignore these interconnections anymore. We can't stay apathetic, and that's one of the things I think that's exciting about the idea of change as well, is that it will help us, I believe, understand how to take action and make a difference and put our consciousness into action.
Well, you're helping me understand the breadth of the term ecosystems, because I'd always thought of it is more having to do with the weather ecology and the land topography and that sort of thing, and rather than the entire system of humans and what we do and our behaviors and and how we can impact or not impact, hopefully in times, the systems that we live in, where we can live comfortably and harmoniously with animals and with land and with, you know, with the types of weather that we do have. It's exciting. It's a very, very exciting time. And then you were talking earlier about the inner evolution and outer change.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that does come from our family. So we kind of go back to first principles as far as Jung is concerned, in a way, to our own environment around that shaped us and is still shaping us.
Mm-hmm.
Who is Elizabeth Fergus Jean or Jean?
Elizabeth Jean, you're right. She's an artist. And the piece on that she has on cultural myths is a beautiful piece that she did for her mother. She's an extraordinary artist to begin with, but the exhibit was really beautiful. And when I saw it, I contacted her. And I said, you know, we need to get this out into the community. This is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the third piece on the section of cultural myths. But,
right.
You know, that idea, you know, artists and poets and economists and ecologists and environmentalists and, you know, psychologists and radio people like yourself, I mean, everyone is a part of the ecosystem. And the whole idea is that we need all this diversity, and we need people's energy, and we need the new images and the new ideas to come in, and because that's what's going to help us change and do our inner work and help create the outer change. But it also is what helps an ecosystem evolve. You know, ecologically, ecosystems never are stagnant. You may be looking at a pond and it may look the same to you every day, but I can guarantee you there are so many changes going on in that pond minute by minute that you don't see. And the analogy or the metaphor is the same for our own psychology. We may look at each other every day and think that, you know, there's no change there, but psychologically, there can be a tremendous amount going on, you know, processing or not. But so that is an incredible image for me to look at ourselves as an ecosystem, and then sort of look at our culture, various cultures, as multiple ecosystems and how they are all connected, and they need diversity. They need a flow of energy and, you know, positive and negative feedback loops, and they need change. And
a lot of diversity comes in.
Exactly.
Right.
Without diversity, any ecosystem will die. And same with the human ecosystem. If we don't have diversity, we die.
So you're teaching eco, however you pronounce it, eco-psychology at several universities. The university is University of California in Santa Barbara and in Boulder, Colorado.
In Naropa.
University and at Antioch in Santa Barbara.
At Antioch, I teach sustainable human ecology in the business program, and we look at ecosystems. We look at human ecology, but we also look at social systems and how this relates to business, how organizations, whether they're nonprofits or small businesses or large corporations, how they also function as a system.
That's so exciting. It's so interesting.
It is, yeah.
We spend a lot of time criticizing our largest institutions, which do cause a lot of problems, but they're also our large institutions that contribute to our culture. And
yeah,
it's
all about are they sustainable or not? Are they, you know, are they sustainable as an institution, and is their philosophy sustainable?
Right.
And that's what you know, the students in the business program get from the human ecology course there. If they want to start a business, here's ideas and ways to look at it as an ecosystem, and how do you want that ecosystem to look and to function. And here's how we know in nature it functions sustainably, and we can take that image and that metaphor and transpose it and look at how we would start a business or run a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. In a sustainable manner as mm-hmm. well. So it's quite fascinating material.
And you're on the editorial board of the new Eco-Psychology Journal, which I hadn't heard about before.
Well, I know. That's a really neat thing. I'm excited about that. It's the first peer-reviewed eco-psychology journal out, which is eco-psychology itself is a new field and basically a new discipline. It hasn't quite found its footing yet. It's not sure if it's going to be accepted and brought in under environmental sciences in the academics under environmental sciences department or in, you know, under psychology in the humanities. My experience has been environmental sciences has embraced it the most, and that's where I teach at UCSB under environmental sciences or in Naropa under environmental sciences.
Well, couldn't it go under more than one? Couldn't it go under,
it's
human under psychology or human sciences?
Yeah, in the humanities. I think that's one of the fascinating things about eco-psychology is that it is a bridge between the sciences and the humanities.
Right. And now neurology and psychology philosophy are all meeting, and and religion and psychology, and there's so many of these that are crossing over that we've tried to pocket only in their own little place, where philosophy in the ancient days was the study of knowledge, and it was a lot of different kinds of things that we were encouraged to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So what I find interesting, Lori, is that your energy is going into these various worlds, these various individual eco-psychologies, I guess, you know, not only in the third world or in smaller countries and smaller cultures, but also in international conferences, as you have done, and also in teaching at various universities that have, they don't all have the same intention.
They,
you know, some of the universities are very broad, big universities, and others are small. And so the fact that your energy is going into each one and carrying from those cultures and those ideas. So you're a wonderful example of what all of us need to do.
Thank you, Tara.
Is to be diverse and look into all these different ways of living and ways of being that we as human beings can contribute to. I congratulate you for starting this new thing, and also for helping us through the publication of Eco-Psychology. It gives us a whole new way of looking, and that, to me, is, I think that Carl Jung would applaud you. That's what I think.
Wow, that's saying a lot. That's
pretty cool.
so indebted, you know, to him, and certainly our leaders after Jung, whether it's Hillman or Jeanette Parry or Stephen Karcher, or I have many, many teachers that I'm indebted to and still learning a great deal from. So
Jeanette is going to be on the program in a few weeks.
Great, great. Well, you know, her book, Wisdom of the Psyche, states in there that all psychologies are eco-psychologies. So she's been obviously a very dear friend, a mentor for me along the way throughout this. And her book's just now come out in French. So it's now in French and Italian and Portuguese and Spanish.
It's a brilliant book.
Yeah, it's a brilliant book.
I've been reading it, and I can't get over the way her mind works.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing mind, and I'm glad I've been in touch with her. And also Dennis Patrick Slattery will be on the show.
Great.
With regard to his new education book, which is another kind of change that we're really talking about.
Yes.
And we're working with another project here in Lake County that will be on a later show I have that has to do with education of families and parents. It has to do with the neurology of small children and their exposure to violence and their exposure to any kind of maltreatment.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited about that, because we really have a new paradigm to reach in our ways of living in order to actually change our culture.
Right.
So,
well, it's wonderful that you have this, you know, type of outlet in show, Tyra, the radio show, because it's the same type of contribution into the culture that we need. It's a communication and a source of communication. And I think it's important, because what you're doing is you're actually forming connections with, you know, with people.
Uh-huh.
And I am grateful and thank you for having this, because I think it's so important that we continue to foster relationship.
Well, I hope that we can do this again sometime. I really enjoyed it very, very much. I also wanted to mention that we're going to have Megan Wagner on this show talking about the Kabbalah and Jesse Eisenstadt talking about the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think we're going to be talking with Jesse more frequently when he's back in the Middle East, with some of his perspectives as he travels through and surfs in that area.
Yeah,
and he's just a brilliant young man.
He is
very,
very
thoughtful.
Energetic, yeah.
And then Robert Romanish is going to be on later, and a woman by the name of Simone Lieberman, who's talking about inclusion and finding talent. And wherever you go, the diversity of finding talent, no matter who it is, everybody has talent and finding that. And so I'm very excited, and I want to thank you so much for being with me today. And I will watch your work and participate in it wherever I can, and hope that everybody will go to either mythology.org or the Institute for, I want to say change, cultural change.
Cultural change, right.
Culturalchange.org.
Oh, thank you so much, Tara. I hope you have a beautiful day.
My pleasure, and you too. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Tyra St. John. on Inside Out. Stay tuned for our stories, our lives.